KALW.
I've been here 2 years, like 12 people have died.
Twelve. 12 people have died in the last 2 years.
And that's right here. Yeah.
Every 2 years, the Bay Area conducts a count of people experiencing homelessness to get funding for services for them.
Wanna count this car?
Yeah, I do.
I think that's probably someone sleeping there. You can tell there's blankets on it to keep it insulated.
We'll take a look at how the point in time count works. Then we hear the story of someone with a disability who found his joy in sports.
It doesn't have to be on ESPN to make it sport. I think that's what our general population tends to say. Oh, how sweet. That's amazing that they're getting out and living their life. But not all sport has to be inspiring. Sometimes people with disabilities just want to be an athlete.
Wheelchair basketball. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. On our show, we focus on local issues, looking at news and culture stories that reflect our daily lives. But in a year like this, what happens on a national level can have huge implications for our state and our region, too. By now, you probably know President Biden has announced that he'll not be seeking re-election and has endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris to take his place. Now their campaign will shift to reintroducing Vice President Harris to the country as a presidential candidate. Here in the Bay Area, we've known her for a long time, since her days as an assistant DA in Alameda County, then San Francisco prosecutor, and then DA. As she fights to secure the Democratic nomination, we will be following what happens on this show and exploring her past here in the Bay Area. So be sure to stay tuned. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. For our first story today, we'll head to Alameda County. Every 2 years, cities and counties across the country send volunteers out for the point-in-time count. It's a surprisingly simple process. Volunteers go out and try to count, literally count, how many unhoused people there are. Data from Alameda County's count came out earlier this summer. It says homelessness is actually decreasing in the county. Counties are required to complete this to qualify for federal funding for homelessness. But how is this funding being used? And are the program it supports actually helping to end homelessness? The count happened in January, but the data takes months to analyze. KALW's emergency and disaster preparedness reporter Ren Farrell went out with the teams in Alameda County to get a better sense of how the count works and what actually happens with the funding. Here's Ren.
At the end of January, around 5 in the morning, I walk into the auditorium of St. Mary's Center, a community center in Oakland. It's full of sleepy volunteers clutching their cups of coffee, nervously waiting for their assignments.
Okay. Welcome to St. Mary. We're thrilled to be a part of 3 locations across the city of Oakland.
It's the morning of Alameda County's 2024 point in time count.
And what are we going to do?
Count.
The point in time, or PIT count, is the primary way communities across America determine how many unhoused people there are in the region. They do this by disbanding hundreds of volunteers to literally count people one by one on the street. I tagged along with volunteers Kawal Ulande and Braz Chabrel.
You want to count this car?
Yeah, I do.
I think that's probably someone sleeping there. You can tell there's blankets on it to keep it insulated.
The morning of the count, we drive up and down the streets of our assigned zone, counting tents, makeshift structures, and cars that it looked like people were living in. We'd plug those numbers into an app.
So they want to do both sides of the street, too.
Both sides of the street?
Yeah, so that side, too. So just keep an eye on that side of the street.
By early afternoon, volunteers in Alameda County were done. They submitted their data, closed the app, and stumbled back out into their regular lives. The full report still hasn't been released, but it's a big deal when it comes out. There are always headlines about if the numbers have gone up or down and what that says about how a region is addressing homelessness. Some people really rely on the data.
Like, I'm really interested in the survey and this, and also the demographic data.
Like Dr. Aislinn Bird. She's a staff psychiatrist with Alameda County Healthcare for the Homeless. She's been working in street medicine for the last 7 years.
Are the folks that we're serving in terms of race and ethnicity, does it match the point in time count? Because if it's off, then that means that we're doing something wrong in our service delivery model.
The data is also important because it's one of a few things that makes cities and counties eligible to receive federal funding for homelessness. On average, Alameda County receives $37 million annually from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD.
They're the federal agency responsible for all of the public housing and Section 8 programs and the other programs to address the housing needs of poor people.
That's Paul Bowden. Paul's the director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, or RAP, a multi-state homeless advocacy group. He used to be unhoused, and he also used to be a case manager in a supportive housing program. He's a true expert on this stuff.
If you participate in the point-in-time headcount, if you have a local homeless coordinating board, like, you get brownie points on the score sheet, and then the cities that get the highest number of brownie points get the most money.
But Paul has a lot of issues with the pit count and how HUD uses it to prioritize funding. His concerns about the count have to do with who it doesn't include. Paul remembers that before cities and counties started doing PIT, they did something called the gaps analysis, a process that took stock of what people in communities around the country told HUD they needed the most.
And they didn't like the results. It was family housing, it was family shelters, it was like, you know, take care of the kids, take care of the families. Well, that's too expensive. Let's do chronic homeless single adults, because that's the most visible population.
Visible because they live on sidewalks and in encampments. On the morning of Alameda County's pit count, almost everyone Braz and Kowal counted fell under this category. We didn't see any families or children. But not everyone who's unhoused is living on the street or in a shelter. Women and children, for example, often stay in motels or with friends as a matter of safety. And technically, according to HUD, they aren't homeless.
Families doubled up, living in SROs, youth that are couch surfing, which is what I did for years when I was out there, no longer count as being homeless. They're now deemed to be poorly housed.
And being poorly housed could mean they aren't eligible for certain services.
If you're sleeping on your cousin's couch and they find out, you're kicked off the waiting list for a shelter bed.
This isn't always the case at every shelter, but Paul says that redefining homelessness allows HUD to simplify its funding priorities. These days, a lot of its funding goes towards PSH, or permanent supportive housing, which is exactly what it sounds like. Advocates, caseworkers, and other officials say that funding from HUD is desperately needed, but it only seems to be going so far.
And we have a new manager. How you doing? Can your mama say hi?
This is Derek Hayes. He lives in a PSH unit in Oakland called Nova. It's six stories with lots of windows and a heavy metal door that you need a fob to open. Derek calls his place the penthouse because he has such a great view.
You can see San Francisco right there. A good shot of San Francisco. You can see the port of Oakland. You can see downtown Oakland. Sometimes I just look out here and just cry because I came a long way, brother.
The permanent in permanent supportive housing means that Derek can live there as long as he contributes 30% of his income to the rent and doesn't violate the terms of his lease by doing things like hoarding, making excessive noise, or having too many guests or friends live with him. Derek loves his place. He loves having a door that locks. But Nova, like many permanent supportive housing units, has its problems.
This leaks.
He points to his fridge.
This leaks. That doesn't work.
The oven doesn't work?
No, it's not an oven. It's a microwave. And so we don't even have a service man. We don't even have a maintenance man now. I just got fired.
Derek says he put in service requests for repairs 3 months ago, but nothing's gotten fixed. We reached out to Nova's property management team about these issues, and they didn't respond. But it's bigger than just a broken microwave. Derek thinks Nova could be doing more to support the residents when it comes to mental health and substance use.
I mean, in 2 years, like 12 people have died.
Two?
12.
12 people have died in the last 2 years.
And that's right here. Right here. Yeah. Some on drug overdoses, some on being in there, a property for weeks without nobody knowing it. That's a large amount of people, man.
Supportive services at Nova are operated by Lifelong Medical Care. They say they can't comment on the number of overdose-related deaths, but they say staff are trained to use Narcan, the emergency medication that can reverse an opioid overdose, and they make it available to the residents for free. They also say they provide referrals to drug treatment programs and, if requested, certain mental health services. But the referral process can be lengthy and bureaucratic. Derek doesn't want to leave Nova. He just wants the county to provide permanent, supportive housing.
I'm frustrated because for other people. My frustration for my apartment, I don't really give a damn about that. Because I lived in the worst.
The S in PSH refers to supportive services, like substance use and mental health support. But residents and advocates say that not all PSH programs provide effective support. And if the programs aren't truly supportive, it creates this cycle that only a select few are successfully escaping from. They say change could start with getting more qualitative data about our unhoused populations, not just numbers. Here's Paul Bowden.
The horrible thing is the point-in-time numbers are being used by the media and by a lot of the national and local homeless groups as an actual number. It's not even close, and they all still use the number and then say, well, but we know that's an undercount. Then why do we keep using that number?
Preliminary data from the PIC count was released in May. It says that homelessness has actually dropped in Alameda County. The decrease is very small, around 300 people. But officials are saying it's the result of efforts by the county to build more housing and move people off the street. On top of that, there was a 19% increase in the number of people accessing shelters, which shows that when resources are available, people jump at the opportunity to use them.
I literally get up and look out my window and get teary-eyed because of the blessing that it is. Turn the key to that lock. Open up my refrigerator for smoking a cigarette on the toilet.
Alameda County did make some changes to the PIC count this year. They didn't just count people. When we came across people who were awake, we asked if they'd be willing to answer some questions about their lives and what they thought they needed in exchange for a $10 gift card.
In the past 3 years, how many times do you think you've been homeless?
Three years.
Your first experience of homelessness, how old were you?
20 years old.
And how long have you been in Alameda County, lived in Alameda County?
The final data from the survey hasn't been released yet, but service providers are hopeful it's a step in the right direction towards ending homelessness. In Oakland, I'm Ren Farrell for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Ren. Alistair Boone also contributed to the reporting of that story. Find more of Ren's stories at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. July is Disability Pride Month, and we've been highlighting stories about the challenges and the joys of living with a disability. From our podcast, TBH, made by, about, and for teenagers, producer Avery Dower tells the story of how the Paralympic coach Trooper Johnson came to train young athletes like himself and what that means to him. Here's Avery.
This is a basketball practice. The players are in wheelchairs. In this clip, I'm playing in a wheelchair basketball scrimmage. It's in Berkeley. It's between the Junior Road Warriors, my team, and the adult team, the All-Stars. A player gets the rebound, dribbles through their defenders, and makes a pass, leading to an open shot. I started playing wheelchair basketball 11 years ago when I was 6. I joined the Bay Area Outreach and Recreation Program. It's a nonprofit that provides and promotes adaptive sports for people with disabilities like me. Everything from sled hockey to power soccer to wheelchair basketball.
I mean, it's just basketball.
Lawrence Johnson. He's my coach. He goes by Trooper, a name given to him by his father.
When you start watching really high-level wheelchair basketball, you can pretty much ignore the chairs and start really seeing basketball.
Trooper is one of the most prolific scorers and three-point shooters in wheelchair basketball history.
There are a couple different modifications to the rules. There's no double dribble in wheelchair ball, so you can take the ball, put it on your lap, take two pushes, and then dribble it again. You can, you know, take the ball and touch it with both hands, fake a pass, fake a shot, and then dribble it again.
He's the only player to make the U.S. national team 15 times, and he's a 9-time gold medalist. In 1992, he played for the U.S. National Paralympic Team competing in Barcelona.
3:15 on the clock. Trooper Johnson for three, and it goes down! Trooper Johnson there, number one man. He's a celebrity here in the USA.
He's a celebrity in the wheelchair basketball community now, but Trooper discovered the sport during a difficult time in his life. Ever since he was a kid, Trooper loved sports. His dad was in the military and signed him up for sports teams whenever they moved. But during Trooper's senior year of high school, in the early 80s, he didn't play any sports. He began using drugs and drinking. One night he was driving in the mountains outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He was drunk. He veered off the road and hit a tree. He got out and tried to move the car.
The car started rolling, and it rolled over me and dragged me down a hill, and I got trapped underneath the car, and it kind of folded me in half backwards and broke my back in two places and then broke a bunch of other stuff. And so it paralyzed me just pretty much at the bottom of my ribs. And from that point on, I was going to be using a wheelchair.
Trooper had never really met anyone who used a wheelchair before his injury. But he did remember once seeing an old woman in a wheelchair in Greece. She was begging for spare change.
That was really the one thing that stuck in my head, because I didn't know about wheelchair sports. I didn't know about anything else, but it's like as soon as they told me I was going to be in a wheelchair, it was like almost like that vision was the one thing that was like, holy crap, you know, that's what I'm going to be. That's what my life is going
to
be like.
Trooper says he refused to accept that image, and others were also rooting for him to stay in sports. One day, a physical therapist drove him to the University of New Mexico.
And she goes, I just have to pick something up in here. And we go into a gym, and there's like, you know, 8 guys playing ball in wheelchairs. And I just was sitting here going, holy crap, you know. And as soon as I found it, I just got excited that I knew that I belonged there.
He still remembers the dimly lit court and trying to take a shot.
And it was just like the most humbling thing in the world because I was always so used to being able to do anything. Like I was kind of one of the kids that could pick up any sport. I could do anything. I was just like able to do stuff, right? And all of a sudden, you know, you're getting this basketball pass to you and you take a shot and it goes 8 feet in the air and you're just like, what the heck was that, right? And then you know, the next shot really didn't go much higher. Like, it was great. I fell out of my chair, you know, and knocked somebody over. I mean, it was just like I just felt great being on the court.
Years after that day, he moved back to the Bay Area for work and found himself back on the basketball court.
Just under streetlights, just like shooting hoops at, you know, midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning.
Trooper soon joined a local team through the Bay Area Outreach and Recreation Program. The team was called the Golden State 76ers at the time, now it's called the Road Warriors. And that was the beginning of his amazing playing career. He played for the NWBA Division I from 1989 to 2004, and he was inducted into their Hall of Fame in 2016. That same year, he became the assistant coach for the USA Women's National Team. The team won gold that year at the Rio Paralympics.
3 golds in 4 Paralympic Games, and they claim the gold, and congratulations to them. There has been no better team here.
Trooper was picked to be the head coach of the USA Women's National Team heading into the 2021 Tokyo Paralympics. As a coach, Trooper pushes all his players to their limits, even the younger generation, and he tests their commitment to the sport. At many points along the way, I considered quitting. As a kid, I just wanted to have fun. Once I was invited up to the varsity level, I felt a huge sense of community. My team works together towards a common goal. We're a force to be reckoned with. Trooper also works with young people who are playing sports for the first time in their lives. He's the coordinator with the Bay Area Outreach and Recreation Program. The program is about more than sports. It's a support network. Older players often give the younger players advice.
They can help them through that process. They have scheduled surgeries. They have things that they have to go through on a regular basis that they know that when the next person on the team has to go through that, they're like, oh yeah, I had that last year. I had it a couple of years ago.
The Bay Area Outreach and Recreation Program has helped me, and so many other young athletes, but programs like this aren't common, and wheelchair basketball is not accessible to everyone. Joshua Pate, a professor at James Madison University, studies disability sports and some of its barriers. He says the sport was first developed as a way to support veterans returning from World War II in England and the United States.
It was all related to veterans and veteran status, which is phenomenal, right? Gives a great outlet, tapping into a market that, or a demographic that certainly is searching for that, you know, physical exertion.
Now wheelchair basketball is considered one of the largest and most popular sports that disabled people can compete in. But the funding doesn't necessarily reflect the demand.
Over the years, it's my opinion that disability sport has been couched only in that area. We see a pretty good level of funding going toward wounded warrior programs or, you know, injured veterans. What we don't see is funding going toward athletes who were born with their disability or athletes who maybe were not veteran status. And so along the way, that becomes this separation between the two populations, even within disability. And I think that's one of the barriers that's holding the disability movement down, is that the cerebral palsy community is not really talking to the, the traumatic brain injury community, which is not talking to the amputee community, which is not talking to the blind and visually impaired community. So it becomes a communication barrier in some ways.
Wheelchair basketball requires a lot of traveling, and the wheelchairs you need to play can be up to tens of thousands of dollars. Even the Paralympic Games are struggling to get sponsors. Stigma around the sport is also part of the problem.
It doesn't have to be on ESPN to make it sport. I think that's what our general population tends to see disability sport and athletes with disabilities and say, oh, how sweet, that's amazing that they're getting out and living their life. And it's this inspirational tone to what they're feeling. But not all sport has to be inspiring. Sometimes people with disabilities just want to be an athlete.
Pate worked on a study with researchers at the University of Houston and the University of Denver to examine the idea of inspiration in adaptive sports. The study shows that athletes playing power soccer didn't want to be viewed as inspirational, but many of their family members did view them that way.
So now in my own life, I live that every day too. When I'm at the gym exercising, it's usually once a month someone will come up and say, they'll tap me on the shoulder, and I know it's coming. They'll say, you know, I just want to let you know that you are such an inspiration. I always respond with introducing myself to them and telling them my name, because I don't want to be known as the person with a disability who's exercising at the gym. I want to be known as Josh, who's exercising at the gym.
This is something that I think resonates with a lot of people with disabilities. I would challenge our listeners to change their viewpoint of disability from inspiration to appreciation. Take my teammate Garnet Silver Hall, for example. He's an incredible player. He has a condition called arthrogryposis. That affects the movement of his arms and his legs. And he's been playing basketball since he was 10 years old.
I always go back to my first nationals. This is like a pivotal time in my adaptive sports career. And it was the first time I'd been around so many people with disabilities. And it blew my mind, I think. Just hundreds and hundreds of people in situations, you know, relative to myself. I think that just made me feel good.
Avery Dower produced that story for the second season of TBH in 2020. Today, Avery's continuing his work in radio at his university station, producing his own show called The Hip Hop Basement. And if you love hearing stories like this one from teenagers about their experiences, we've got good news for you. The fifth season of TBH is in production right now. Keep an ear out for later this summer. You can find the rest of the TBH episodes at klw.org/TBH. Today's Cross Currents team includes Michaela Sia, Christopher Alam, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.